Testing, testing. Hello, hello. You're listening to WMUC-FM College Park 90.5. You know where to adjust your headphones there, right?
Oh,
the volume. You can mess with the volume there.
Oh, look at that. It's hiding under the desk.
Yes. As you can hear, we've got a guest that today's Moral Hazard. If you don't know now, now you know. Moral Hazard every Thursday, 10 p.m. on WMUC-FM College Park 90.5. Last week, we weren't here because I won't say what I believe because I don't want to get sued for defamation, but I will say I went to Green Turtle and what did I eat? I think it was a burger from there and I immediately got sick. I'm not saying it was them, but I'm saying that two things happened one after the other in quick succession. Look, Green Turtle College Park, if you want to make it up to me, I'll take a $250 gift card.
Good Lord, $250? How much food are you planning on eating over there?
Look, it's not about the food.
I guess not.
Green Turtle has many offerings for their clients over 21. And if they were to give me $250 of whatever I choose off the menu, now that would be splendid.
That would be. I'll tell you what. To make up for some of the Green Turtle slander, I have had their wings and I did approve of their wings.
You did approve? No, because they're not going to give me the $250 if you speak
well
of them.
Okay, well, I'm not the one you're. I do not need $250. You can give Steven $250.
This isn't CNN Crossfire. We have one single viewpoint here on Moral Hazard.
Oh, of course,
and
yeah.
It's that Green Turtle needs to make things right with me, or else I'm going to continue to tell everyone that I got sick right after eating their food. And we haven't done introductions. Welcome to Moral Hazard. I'm your host, Stephen Fung. We're here every week. We're doing business, economics, politics, policy. I'll cut the spiel because we have a guest here in the studio today. Why don't you introduce yourself to the wonderful listeners?
Hey, I am W. Wade DeVinny II. Most people just call me Wade. I am here with Stephen today because I am getting my own radio show soon, so I will be out of Steven's hair, but until then, you know, we are joining him today. He's going to show me the ropes. He's going to teach me how to not, you know, make the FCC goons angry. Yeah. And, we're going to have a good time talking about policy and the what have you. And we got a lot, you know, this current political climate has given us a lot to work with today.
Yeah. And, well, look, you know, your first lesson, Wade, is that the FCC, Brendan Carr, chairman of the FCC, only does anything if you are a liberal talk show. And thankfully, Moral Hazard is the most right-wing.
Oh, of course.
The most right-wing show that could have ever crossed the radio. But we already know. We know radio is already predominantly right-wing medium, but we're taking it seven steps further.
Oh yeah,
and
you have to.
That's what separates the wolves from the sheep here. All right, what Rush Limbaugh couldn't do is get up on here and yell about things in a way that's convincing and will ensure that the Libertarian Party wins the next election.
Oh yeah,
we're big libertarians here. Actually.
There you go.
But, yes, the new year is upon us. Time keeps moving. The world keeps changing. You don't, but we're here to help you transition into the new era. And with that, we're talking about everything new that's happening, everything new that could be of some importance to you, whether it's what you pay at the pump, what you pay at the grocery store, what laws are randomly getting passed that affects your bottom line, your well-being, whether you're in a detention center in Western Maryland. That's what we take care of. That's what we take. We take care of you, because unlike all the other nonsense media out there, and like CNN and Fox News and and Cocomelon and
that was your next.
We're talking about what matters.
What matters? Yeah, yes. Naturally.
So Wade, you've got a show coming up.
Yeah, I do.
Tell us about it.
So it's gonna be called Game Rex. That's Game WRECKS. See, Steven here is the policy aficionado. I have only been allowed to vote because the Constitution says so. I'm an informed enough voter. I'm a journalist. I kind of have to be. But my wheelhouse is video game news. You know, what's going on in the industry. you know, what each news item means for gamers. So I can't wait to see you guys on that. I know the Venn diagram between policy enthusiasts and gamers is a circle. So I know, so naturally, so I can't wait to hear, I can't wait to see all of you guys on my show.
Yeah, or you can't wait for them to hear you.
Yeah, hear me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
The best thing about radio is that you can be as ugly as you want, and it doesn't change anything.
There you go. Well, that's, you know, the face. You got a, someone says you got a face for radio. You know, not, you it's know, not a compliment.
My economics teacher in high school, my senior year of high school, he said that I have a face for radio, and
now,
it took me a second to get it, and it stuck with me till this day.
I feel like all high school history and economics professors all have, like, weaponized sarcasm.
Yeah, that's
in
true.
Because in my high school, you know, it was like, it was the same thing, you know, they were, it was came effortlessly to them. You know, it's someone in my history class, his name was Mr. Curtin, I'll never forget. There was this guy who, he said something, and this guy said, oh, I knew that, and he stops the class, he says, all right, everyone stand up and clap for this guy, because he knew that, and everyone stands up, everyone starts clapping, and, you know, thank God I was on his good side. I think he still teaches there, actually, I think he still teaches there, but man, he was. They're all like just equipped with all the sarcasm. It's fascinating.
You know, you went to a public school, right?
I did for high school.
It might be that that's how you survive.
You need
to have that kind of biting sarcasm and the jaded eyes to make it to make it in a public high school.
Because they're gonna test you, and you gotta
those kids.
Look, I knew some teachers. My math teachers could never control the crowd. My math teachers would be terrible, like riot response. Well, I guess they all would, but they were like, I'll wait. And then my history teachers would say stuff that I can't repeat on the radio to people who are, the thing is, you don't have to be the mean teacher in order to command respect. You just have to be scary enough so that, you know, what is it? Speak softly and carry a big stick.
That's what you gotta do. That's the Teddy Roosevelt method.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
We do that here in the United States to this day, except now we speak loudly, and our big stick can get blown up by $40,000 drones.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's really not that as balanced as it was back in the day when we were just bullying Panama.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, I mean, Panama's been getting a kind of a break the past 100 years, but everyone else hasn't.
Everyone else has had a tough time. Panama, well, I mean, even Panama's still, I remember, like, early on in Trump, too, they were getting mad at Panama because they were allowing a bit more Chinese investment than the United States administration would allow.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I mean, look, we're a long way away from Monroe Doctrine.
I mean, I see what you mean in that we've kind of lost the plot, but, you know, for some, like, we're still carrying its namesake with the Don Roe Doctrine.
Yeah, the Don Roe Doctrine.
You ever heard that?
I've never heard that, no.
Well, I mean, it all came around when we started messing with Venezuela. Like, this idea of a Don Roe Doctrine. Because you remember the original Monroe Doctrine.
I thought it was isolationism. Am I getting this wrong?
No, you are right. The original,
I am right. Okay,
the original
so I'm right.
Monroe Doctrine was that the United States should do its best to remove any foreign interference from the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, but I think I got it wrong a little bit because I was thinking that the United States should remove its own foreign influence from
No. It's
okay.
Just that
this
the Eastern Hemisphere
video games.
Stays away from the Western Hemisphere.
Now
it's that we actually have to have our fingers in every sovereign nation
naturally.
In the Western Hemisphere.
Of course.
I have
there
your
can
hand
be no
in the
other
cookie
way.
Jar. I mean, when Cuba's, you know, they got blackouts outside of Havana. I mean, because of the embargo, they're basically concentrating all of their power to Havana, to the major cities, and the rural countryside is kind of getting the boot.
But that's good because our tax dollars are paying for it, so naturally.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to
pay for the blockade.
Look, when I get to do spring break in my super duper senior year, and I get to go to Cuba for my spring break, you know, then it'll all be worth it.
There you
go. You got to turn it into a vacation spot. I need billions of U.S. Investment and an indescribable and inscrutable amount of U.S. goodwill being spent on Cuba for no reason. A country with nothing.
You know what they got? You know what they got in Cuba? I don't know.
Doctors.
Well, that. But you know they've got this place. See, Fidel Castro, huge dairy guy. Right, just dairy
really?
In general. Yeah, you can look it up.
I'm gonna try.
But he, there's this place called Copalia there, and he commissioned it, and it's like this ice cream super complex. Yeah, there.
Oh, yeah, wow.
It's this ice cream super complex. The dude loved his ice cream. There's a story that he once like ate 18 scoops of ice cream in one sitting. But if you do go to Cuba, if you leave your heart back in Havana, then you gotta go see Copalia.
Is the ice cream, do you know if the ice cream's good?
I'm sure it is, because I think someone would have gotten killed over bad ice cream there.
Because, I mean, look,
way back in
the United States, we have, there is a Copalia in every strip mall. It's called Cold Stone or Baskin Robbins.
Well, yeah, well, naturally.
I mean, I bet they don't have the founder's favorite.
Look, here's the thing. I feel like when the government, no matter what the government is, if they put all of their power into making an ice cream store, it can't be bad. Like, anybody, like, you take any Better Dead Than Red hardliner, and you ask them, if the Cuban government put all their resources into making one big ice cream store, would it be good? If they say no...
If they say no,
I wouldn't believe them.
If they say no, you need to point them to the capitalist poster child that is Cold Stone, where they've somehow convinced you that ice cream without flavoring is the best type.
I haven't been to Cold Stone.
Sweet cream?
You have some references that I'm not.
Oh, you gotta go to Cold Stone.
Well, the last time I went to Cold Stone was I think last year for like a date, and then we immediately started going to. Oh, what's that ice cream place? I can't quite... It starts with a J.
Ben and Jerry's.
No. But I am a fiend.
Jubilee?
There it is.
Yes! I've never been there.
You should go. I'm trying to say... There's a way to say this without triggering FCC rules. But I
just
had
Just say
a good,
you've been there.
I have been there, yeah. I have been there.
Well,
it's been a good time. Don't come after me, Brandon Carr. Please don't come after me.
Well, look, I'll tell you something about Cold Stone, because the sweet cream flavor. It is their front runner flavor. It's called sweet cream. They've had it forever. They've got all the flavors, all the mixings based on it. It is vanilla ice cream without vanilla.
So
it's
like
just
a lump
the flavor.
It's a lump of sauce.
Yeah, no, it's just salt, milk, and it was just salt, cream, and sugar and ice.
God, we're going after all the corporate city.
Yeah.
Green Turtle,
Green
Cold
Turtle.
Stone.
Look,
we're coming after
Cold
everybody.
Stone, Cold Stone, if you want to make things right with me, I will take. You know what? This isn't the same as what was going on with Green Turtle. I'll be nice to you. You can do a $150 gift card.
Oh,
we'll wipe the slate clean.
You got the Stephen Fung mercy today.
Yeah,
This is a special
flavor of black men. Nah, I'm kidding. yeah, but so I, you know, let's talk about video games.
Oh, let's. There you go.
You're doing a video game show.
Yeah.
Talk show.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So what are you gonna do? Are you gonna be reviewing a single game each episode,
no,
or is it kind of just talking about the news?
I want to be, what I told the hiring manager when they got here, I want to be the Rachel Maddow of video games, man. I want to be, I will be heavily opinionated, I will go through the news, and I will tell, you know, I what I want to do is what are you playing section, right? Because I play all kinds of things. You know, I'm going to, it's tough to do reviews too because, again, some rules, but you know, I will give my full opinions on... So, like, for example, right now I've been playing Resident Evil, The Umbrella Chronicles, and that's the on-rails shooter for the Nintendo Wii, right? Right now, so I started playing it two nights ago.
You're playing old games.
So, yeah. Oh, okay. The majority of my net worth is in video games. Let's just leave it at that. But, yeah. Oh, so it's that, the one with Wesker. Yeah, that one.
This one.
The difference between this Resident Evil and every other Resident Evil is it's an on-rails shooter. And what it does is it takes original Resident Evil games and it truncates each one into three bite-size, like, laser shooter levels, right?
What?
Yeah.
So it's not even its own...
No. So this was a big reason for this. You know, Nintendo was trying to get a bunch of games that showed... You know, I believe this was a 2007 release. You'd have to... And the Wii came out in 2006. Mm. So, at this point, Nintendo was trying to find games that would justify the Wii. Surprise! The packing game, Wii Sports, justified the Wii 100 times over.
Yeah.
But they were trying to figure out, okay, well, what is a game that we could put out that... what's a game that we could put out that really uses the ability to point at the screen and have the pointer show up where you're pointing... to the best of its potential.
Yeah.
So it so they went to Capcom and they said, "Hey, can you make something like that for us?" Now they didn't want to, you know, the Resident Evil series is sacred to Capcom, right?
Mm.
But they were willing to say, "Look, we're not going to give you an original Resident Evil. We don't want anything in the actual canon that you can only experience with this because we know it's not going to be the best."
Yeah.
You know. So what they did is they said, "All right, well, look, we have." We're kind of sitting on Resident Evil Zero, which we just released for the GameCube a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We got the original Resident Evil, which we released a GameCube version for, and people really liked that.
So sorry, just to interrupt, you mentioned on rails. Just for the listener, because I think I'm fairly certain I know what you mean by when you say on rails. But like when you go to the arcade, and you're shooting at the screen, and you're shooting the Tyrannosaurus, and it just moves for
you. It's moving for you. That is exactly what an on-rail shooter is.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, it's called on rails because you don't control where the movement goes.
Yeah, it's like you're on a roller coaster.
Exactly.
Okay,
that is exactly what it is. So, and I can't quite remember what the third game is because I've only gotten through the first two truncated versions of the games. But they change a couple things. I can see here that IGN liked it. I'm not a...
I know you want to work at IGN, but
I'd
a 7.9 being good is ridiculous to me. Their scale is so nonsensical.
Look, So on my website that I was running for a while, it's currently under maintenance, but I try not to review games in terms of like just a numerical thing, because I don't think it gives you enough information.
Yeah.
I like to think about, you know, is it... Well, I mean, I'm going to sound a little hypocritical here, but is it... What did I think of it in one word?
Good.
Good. So, for this, it would be like, underwhelming, say. And, you know, what's a reason you should play it for? And I think the reason would be if you're really jonesing for that arcade experience... that would be the reason to play it. And the best thing about it is, I guess, I haven't really decided what the best thing about it is. Look, I don't want to act like it's terrible. There are some redeeming qualities to it. Mm. Like, for example, it's one of the only times outside of Resident Evil Mercenaries that you can play as one of the antagonists, Albert Wesker. I think that's interesting. I think that's an interesting...
Yeah.
Feature. And you know what? It does use the Wii controls well.
It uses the Wii controls well? You're pointing at the screen. That's like what that you're not even using the nunchuck.
The nunchuck is there for the second set of buttons.
Okay.
But you gotta contextualize it, because, you know, at the time, you know, they needed ways to sell the Wii, especially to the non-casual audience. Because, you know, although the Wii Satoru Iwata could have written the book on, you know, the Blue Ocean strategy, right? Even though he read a book on the Blue Ocean strategy, and that's how the Wii was born.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo knew, this
is cool. Wait, talk more about the Blue Ocean strategy.
Okay, so basically, all right, so the Blue Ocean strategy is basically not when you aren't directly competing with your competitors. So,
yeah.
So the story goes, Satoru Iwata reads a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, and he decides, you know what we're doing? Last generation with the GameCube, the PS2 outsold us, and if if the Xbox, the original Xbox, if it didn't outsell them, it came pretty darn close. Mm-hmm. So he says, all right, well, what's a market that the video game, that video games doesn't really cater to? Well, everybody else, you know? Mm-hmm. People who aren't, you know, people who don't want to follow the plot of Mass Effect. They, you know, people who want to just have a fun little experience that they can have with their friends and family.
Yeah.
People who don't necessarily understand right away intuitively how to use a video game controller. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the Nintendo executives and he says, all right, we got to figure something out here. And then they come up with the Wii Remote because it's like a TV remote. Everyone knows how to use a TV remote.
Yeah.
You got the big button in the middle that does all the things. You got some side buttons. You point at it and it, you know, where you point, it goes. They release Wii Sports. It absolutely shatters its own day one records.
Mm-hmm.
It is, for like 3 years, the Wii was so hard to get your hands on.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what the idea that the Wii's strategy was built upon this book of Blue Ocean.
Yeah,
because I mean, you see so many successful products, and it's a simple concept. The ideas in the Blue Ocean strategy are in every Econ 101 class.
Pretty much. Yeah.
When you're in monopolistic competition, your best strategy is to just be as far away from all the other people. Just make your own market build that brand.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that they were able to just shoot out by, you know, doing something on a corporate level that most students would have already been trained to do.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, the video game industry had gotten so tunnel visioned at that point because, you know, they just wanted to keep going with what worked, you know, because, and actually, weirdly enough, Nintendo kind of, you know, started that trend, although Sony really kicked it off with their PlayStation, but, you know, it's easy, I think people underestimate how risky it is to pivot, because the GameCube did not do well in terms of sales, the N64 really didn't do well in terms of sales,
mm-hmm.
So Nintendo's here, and, you know, it's hard to think about these days, but they weren't bulletproof going into 2004, 2005, 2006, they were not bulletproof. They had, you know, they were competing. They knew what worked for them. They knew that 3D, that 3D shooters were all the rage. I mean, and I say that, you know, it wasn't really shooters. Just the 3D graphics craze was still kind of going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking a huge risk because the HD graphics craze was about to get started. And I don't know if you remember, the Wii does not output into HDMI.
No, it doesn't.
It does not.
It doesn't.
It's and you gotta remember, it's in the same generation as the PS3 and Xbox 360. If you don't have a TV that outputs into standard definition, you're out of luck.
Yeah. That's so fascinating to me. The idea that video game production in that era was, and I mean, it is to some extent, it's kind of reverted now, where people don't want to take risks, because it reminds me of a topic I covered last semester. You remember Netflix came out with K-pop Demon Hunters?
Yes,
and that topped the charts of Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it is their most to this currently. It is their most viewed. It is their most viewed production.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but
yeah.
I believe it.
At the time, it was at least top three. But it was the same story. It was the same story of, I mean, and in that case, Netflix didn't even believe in it.
Right.
They didn't want to take risks either. They put this thing out, minimal budget. They had no advertising for it. They were advertising some movie with The Rock and Kevin Hart again. No. It was The Rock.
Thing?
It was The Rock and Jake Gyllenhaal. It was like Red something. It flopped.
Red one. It was the Santa one.
Yeah. Okay.
Like the freaking Santa one.
And
yeah. It had We Are Farmers guy, J.K. Simmons.
Yeah. And
he was Santa.
But I mean, Netflix inadvertently, despite all their worst efforts, they managed to find a blue ocean with that.
Yeah.
And I mean, the difference between that and the Wii is stark, because with the Wii, there was a great deal of intentionality. That mm-hmm. thing was marketed like crazy before it hit out.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a hit, but it was definitely a more controlled hit than what Netflix did, because Netflix wasn't able to even capitalize on K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yeah, but they were able. I agree 100% that Nintendo definitely facilitated the Wii's success a lot more than Netflix facilitated the success of K-pop Demon Hunters. But what I think what I think is admirable in all of this is, you know, Netflix is bulletproof. Netflix is bulletproof 100%. There is, if Netflix produces a flop, then on to the next one. Nintendo was in a bit of a and I'm not saying that, you know, they were like on the verge of bankruptcy, but
yeah,
they were in a bit of a
they needed a hit.
And it happened before, you know, the generation prior, the Sega had bowed out of console manufacturing because of how awful their previous console, the Saturn, was, even though the Dreamcast was a wonderful console that I actually own and I love. You know, it just wasn't, you know, if a Titan does something royally stupid, then sometimes... Now, and again, this isn't to take away from K-pop Demon Hunters, because I think one stakeholder here that we're not, that I'm not adequately taking into account is the producers. You know, it's a jungle out there for those smaller animators, because you make one flop and it's, and you're updating your LinkedIn. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So they took a risk, and Netflix wasn't backing him as much, because I got to tell you, I don't remember, you know, anecdotally, I don't know if I'm the target for targeted ads for K-pop Demon Hunter, but I didn't see any ads for it. I saw ads when the critics rolled in saying, "Oh my god!"
Once it hit, then you put
the advertising.
And
in
I mean, that baffled me, because they would have had, they would have done focus groups. They would have had, like, you know, they would have done limited screenings and, you know, seen how people responded. There was no merchandising,
right?
No advertising. Mm-hmm. There was no merchandising for a cartoon that was a hit, and they had to wait for it to be a hit, then try and merchandise.
Yeah.
They made money off it.
No,
but
of course.
They missed they were late on that flash in the pan.
Yeah. I think one thing is, and, you know, I can't speak to any Netflix executives personally. I don't know them. I've never met them. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even tell you any of their names, but I think sometimes, just speaking about, you know, some people I know, you know, you go through focus groups, you hear what other people say, but you have a gut feeling. Mm-hmm. You have a feeling,
yeah,
and you think you know, and, you know, and these Netflix, you get to be a Netflix executive, I would assume, by being right a lot. But, you know, you say, well, you know.
Or just, you know, just getting lucky and knowing the right people.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. Yeah. That's the fun way of doing
it. You know how Nicolas Cage was supposed to be Superman?
Well, Cage is Francis Ford Coppola's, his real name is Nicholas Coppola.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know he was supposed to be Superman.
Yeah, no, well, he was cast for a Superman movie, and they went through, like, I think halfway through production, the main producer on it was, he was someone's stylist, but he had no idea about anything.
Mm-hmm.
They just gave him the keys, he went, he made a Superman that was completely, like, off the mark. It was so bad, and they just had to shut it halfway through, lost millions of dollars.
Seriously?
Because, I mean, producers, in Hollywood, no one knows anything. That is the mantra. No one knows anything in Hollywood. Because everyone's just, you know, flying by the seat of their pants. You know?
Yeah. I would have loved to see that, though. Well, yeah.
It's lost now.
Well, Lex Luthor, I don't know if you know me. I don't know any Nick Cage movies.
Well, you've got the acting down.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, I know his voice very well.
Yeah.
Like, one movie I've been meaning to see is The Massive Weight of Unbearable Talent. I can appreciate Nicolas Cage as an idea. I've just never seen any. I don't think I've seen any of his movies.
What's that? The God of War. That one was all over FX.
Oh, Lord of War. I have seen Lord of War.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have seen Lord of War. What am I saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that one was pleasant, I guess. I don't know.
Well, Lex Luthor, I'll trade you 100 pounds of kryptonite for... What,
three guns.
Yeah, there you go.
That seems like a good deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, he sucked as Superman. He had, like, a bob in... It was completely nonsensical. Anyways, we do need to play a PSA. We play a PSA every episode because something nonprofit, something, something. So we got a PSA today. It's good, and the weather's getting good. We're talking about Lyme disease.
Oh, yeah.
Don't
Lyme disease.
Tick check.
Oh, yeah.
While you're outside exercising in the sun and fresh air, make sure to check yourself for ticks after being in woodsy areas like the Paint Branch Trail. Tick bites can cause a serious illness called Lyme disease, which is highly preventable and treatable if caught early. Maryland is in the top 15 states with the highest number of reported Lyme disease cases. The best way to deal with this illness is to prevent it, so avoid going off trail into the woods. And if you have to, make sure to check yourself afterwards for ticks or signs of bites, which usually appear as red bullseyes. If you feel any potential Lyme disease symptoms, like a rash, fever, joint pain, or muscle aches, immediately go to the University Health Center. Don't let this stop you from enjoying the great outdoors. Just be alert when you're outside and prevent this infection.
Okay, you heard it here first. Check for ticks. Use the bug spray or something. And don't walk in the tall grass because Pokemon will jump out at you.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I do?
What do you do?
I got cowboy boots, right?
You have cowboy boots? Dude, these
you can't. So here's the thing. I'm 5'7". I don't like that, right?
Yeah,
so I got about 2 inches. I got about 2 inches of heel right
dude,
up here.
Dude, that's solid. Dude, those are nice.
I can walk in all the tall
grass. Where'd you get them?
So these I got in the town I grew up in, or a little outside of it. It's called Mosaic Center. There's an actual boot store there. But my original pair of cowboy boots, I was in Montana, and you know, I was in high school at the time, and you know how much high schoolers care about the way they look.
Well, in Montana, they all have to wear cowboy boots.
Well, yeah, they're all wearing cowboy boots over there. So I figured, I'll bring the trend to Virginia. Why not? So I did it. And, of course, people gave me the looks at first, but, you know, I'm a little stubborn. I was like,
Well,
you.
I'm the cowboy guy.
Yeah,
I'm the cowboy guy.
I'm the cowboy boot guy now.
You know
so
what?
I still have them, man. I
may not sit at the cool table, but I have the cowboy
boots. Oh, I was sitting at the cool table eventually.
I was sitting at the cool table eventually.
Yeah,
well,
they love my cowboy boots.
They love the cowboy boots.
Yeah.
I got a pair of cowboy boots last semester.
Right?
I didn't do my research.
Mm.
Ostrich leather is apparently, like, really annoying to have on your shoes.
Is it?
Because you can't get it wet.
So this is goat leather. I mean, these are just getting wet. These are fine, you know? My mother always tells me, oh, you gotta be careful getting your boots wet. They've been getting wet all the dang time. They're fine.
Well, it's meant for that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you gotta be careful. Like,
exotic bird leather is not the best. Yeah. Listen,
I'm actually
anyone...
glad you said that, because I was looking at some... ostrich
dude, they
leather.
Look so cool.
They bumps
look so
on them.
Cool.
They
but
look,
you'd
yeah.
like if
can't
unless unless you've got like a red carpet in Wyoming to get to, like you will never have any use for ostrich.
I didn't know
birds.
They had. You know, there are only two pairs of escalators in Wyoming.
Is
like
that
the state?
Is that
look,
really
look,
the
look
case?
Look it up. Don't take my word for it. There are only two escalators in all of Wyoming. Yeah, there you
go. I looked up how many and it just autofilled how many escalators. Wyoming only has two public escalators in the entire state. Both are in the same town of Casper. Wait, so there are no escalators in their capital?
But then public would be government, wouldn't it? So I guess not.
What's the capital? Wyoming?
Cheyenne.
Okay,
yeah, Cheyenne.
Yeah. All right, I still got it.
Yeah.
You know, and in high school, I used to do this club called It's Academic, which is basically just like
It's
competitive
Academic.
Trivia.
Yeah.
I only remember two things. It was all the state capitals and like a bunch of like authors for like classic books. Canon authors. And I don't even remember their... I didn't even remember their first names because all you needed was the last name. So like at one point, I could like... Basically, like, the 100, like, top literary canon books, I could tell you the last name of the author, but not the first name.
Let's check your work. Anne of Green Gables.
I don't know that one.
Oh,
who is
well,
that?
The heck if I know?
No.
I don't know. I'm a video game guy.
That wasn't on the list.
let's try another one. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Vern.
There you go. Yeah. Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, I knew this one. Dumas?
Yeah, it's Dumas.
Ah!
Yeah. Frankenstein.
Shelley.
All right, we could go
here
all day. He's got it. He's got it.
He has the
W.A. Divinity stamp of approval.
Yeah, well, that's why they give me the big bucks, all right?
Yeah, of course.
Moral Hazard, sponsored by the Heritage Foundation, sponsored by Cato Institute, sponsored by Oracle. We'll take the money. We're going to spend it. Look, I would like to thank all of our actual donors for their contributions this past semester. You have been able to fund next week, I'm going to Florida. We're going to be interviewing Cubans over what's going on in Cuba right now.
That's crazy. Really?
No, I'm going to Florida I'm going to Miami.
Oh, well, there you go. You have me.
I'm going to Miami with my friends.
Oh, you have me hook, line, and sinker,
and I'm going to ride mopeds around.
Hell, there you go.
And get if coffee.
I'm sure you'll find a Cuban somewhere.
No, I would, yeah. I mean, I'm going to Miami.
Yeah.
I could if I wanted to. I'm off the clock.
Well, there you go.
Look, this show ends when I'm gone. Look, there's nothing making me go the extra mile right now.
No, there you go.
But I do want to go to the bare minimum, and I do want to talk about what has transpired the past 2 weeks. I wasn't here last week because I had, thanks, Green Turtle. last Saturday, I believe it was last Saturday, the United States blew up Ali Khamenei. Mm-hmm. That was the Ayatollah of Iran at the time. Yeah. And that kicked off what most people would call a war, but for the sake of the fact that Congress didn't actually declare war, we have to call it a conflict in Iran. And this conflict involves us blowing up basically the entire pyramid of leadership down like 7 levels. You know, there's been a lot of bombing. There's a lot of air. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of air, basically an entirely an air invasion, some ships.
Yeah, I don't think they've put boots on. I mean, I don't have that in front of me.
They're weighing it. They're weighing a small scale land invasion.
Yeah. Can I touch on something really fast? It really bothers me about the war terminology thing. You know, because Trump did campaign on, oh well, you know, I'm gonna end the war in Ukraine. No war. No war under Trump. Well, this isn't a war. This is, you know, the majority of people don't, when they say I don't want war, they're not saying, oh, I don't want Congress to
I don't want Congress.
An act.
Yeah, it's, my Cauchy, you know, bet that Congress wouldn't declare war. That's what everyone's voting on.
That, yeah, and I guess we could go on Cauchy, but we got to get this. But the Cauchy thing is crazy too. But you know, it's, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it's a duck shaped war in Iran. I'm sorry. It is.
No, and that's definitely.
You're not getting any points because technically it's a retaliatory counter of this, that, or whatever. I don't care. I don't care. It's like when Scott, in the words of Scott the Waz, take the scissors, go, it's a manually operated fiber divider. No, it's
not
scissors. It's scissors.
But yeah, I mean, the primary issue I find is a rational justification for being in there in the first place.
Yeah.
I think we're playing the greatest hits, you know? Mm-hmm. They're 2 weeks away from getting a nuke. Whoop-dee-doo, all right?
It was like SNL said, they've been 2 weeks away from getting a nuke for the past 15 years.
Literally since 2003, they've been 2 years away from 2 weeks away from getting a nuke.
Yeah.
It's always, look, Iran has their own game. It appears that Iran had their own game that they were playing diplomatically. So they would report their enriched uranium content. They were mandated to report their enriched uranium content.
That was under
United
the Obama,
Nations.
The deal they had with Obama.
Yeah. And they were compliant with it for years until we blew up their facilities in June, and they did not report because, our enriched uranium and all got blown up. If they didn't, well, guess whose fault that is? Because they can't report because you just gave them plausible deniability. If they have it, they're using it as the same mutually assured destruction leverage that every other country was using during the Cold War. Yeah. And I don't know. I find it a bit irksome that we are wasting, you know, quite a bit of taxpayer money to make it rain oil in Tehran, and to, you know, create mushroom clouds that aren't nukes, but they are, you know, they're pretty close when you blow up everything. It's getting very messy.
Yeah, and I think one point that's important to hit too is, you know, a lot of the straw man argument I've seen a lot is, oh well, does that mean, you know, you don't like the fact that, what was his name?
Ali Khamenei?
Khamenei. Oh, you liked Ali Khamenei? He's dead now and you're mad about. No, Ali Khamenei was, in my opinion, an evil person. You know, 30,000 protesters were dead. That doesn't mean you bombed the country. Look, yes, I understand, you know, it would be nice to be able to, you know, fix all the evil overseas, but people are dying in this. I mean, it's not like a video game where if you throw the grenade, it's not going to hurt you. You know, it's you know, people are dying. When you go to war, you're putting your cards down. You're putting the chips down. You know, nobody is saying that it's not an objectively good thing in a vacuum that Ali Khamenei is dead. To heck with that guy. But the problem is just the situation that has arisen. You know, it's like if I saw a cockroach on my porch and I killed it with a shotgun. You know, nobody's defending Ali Khamenei. That's just ignoring the overall problem here.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also this aspect of like, you know, it's either we blow him up or nothing. There's a very alarming false dilemma that seemed to arise here, where it's, you know, he's getting breakfast outside. We have to blow him up or everything's going to go wrong because they're going to get a nuke. First of all, we still don't even know where the enriched uranium is.
Yeah, that's true.
But what, you know, moral hazard, we talk about economics and we talk about, you know, policy and all that.
Yep.
So I want to talk about for a second what the United States gets out of this. All right.
You're going to have to be the one to speak on that.
Well, right now we're getting literally nothing. We're getting literally nothing. We are losing the United States taxpayers. The nation as an abstraction is losing so horribly right now in what should have been just in and out like Venezuela.
Right.
So one thing that everyone's talking about is the difference in cost in this war.
Right.
So Iran has very cheap drones. I believe they're called Arabic for witness, or it's Persian for witness. And I have to find what the actual name for it was. But these drones are cheap. They're dirt cheap. They're in like low thousands.
I was going to say I think the number you gave me was 40,000.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it
something
might even
to
be
that
lower
end
than that. I can pull that up. Yeah. But these drones are incredibly cheap. Oh, here it is.
Yeah, here we go.
Yeah. Okay. So,
this is from Bloomberg, by the way.
Yeah. 132 or was 136. 136.
There we go.
Shahed 136. It basically means witness. This is basically the Bloomberg article covering it. Iran's cheap, plentiful weaponry puts U.S. military under unprecedented strain. They're dirt cheap. I can't find the exact number here, but they are very cheap. I believe the number was 40,000, approximately.
I'm seeing 50,000.
20 to 50.
20 to 50. All
20
right,
to 50,000.
So 40 is probably in the... Yeah, that's not... Yeah. That is not a lot.
But, I mean, even the technology it takes to mitigate those drones costs far more. And, you know, when it's an interceptor, it's getting destroyed on impact. We are spending millions for every, you know, $50,000 that Iran spends. You know, there is really something very dangerous about playing with a country that doesn't care about the rules as much as you do.
No, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Iran has targeted quite a few, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, several desalination plants. Which is against international law.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah, you're not supposed to do that.
But I mean, they're blowing up refineries. They're blowing up desalination plants. They are causing economic havoc. They are putting mines in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, I saw that.
And the strain. So the Strait of Hormuz takes about it processes about 20% of oil shipments go through the Strait of Hormuz.
That would explain what's going on over at Chevron.
Yes, and. Are you invested in Chevron?
No, but my car is.
Okay, yeah. So, today, actually, this developed today, the United States is relaxing a rule that required U.S.-owned ships to dock in to dock with oil for the United States. Shipments of oil to be carried on United States ships to the United States.
I didn't hear. Oh.
And so that, we have to do it because of the issues with the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is being felt on a global level, but I mean, at home, we are taking money out of the pockets of our own industries and handing them over to other nations.
Yeah.
Now we are importing this service because we decided to go and get in a game of hand grenades with Iran.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just across the board, there's just so much economic strain being felt. And everyone likes to think that the wartime economy is the best economy.
Yeah, everyone brings up World War II and the, you know, the absolute boom. But you know, back then, you know, we were requisitioning Ford to make airplane jets. That is one, you know, it probably wouldn't have been sustainable for more than the amount of time, which it didn't have to be. But, and two, that's for an all-out war. That's for a total war. That's not for whatever we're calling this.
And I mean, even back during World War II, times were still tight.
Yeah.
It was after World War II that the United States was able to kind of reap. Because remember, we still had Rosie the Riveter. You know, they were everyone was working because we needed all hands on deck. There was not leisure time.
No.
It was not fun. Nope. Everyone had to put their heads down to get through this issue. And so while in World War II, there was a lot of, production and, you know, circulation, there was still like a lot of strain. And what we're seeing here is that we're not even really getting the production anymore.
No.
With the supply chain constraints that we're facing, we actually are having to outsource some things.
Yeah, I've heard that. What are some of the things that they're outsourcing? Because I have heard that it's coming out of. I know microchips is one.
I mean, the United States runs generally a major trade deficit. The previous GDP report actually shows that our trade deficit has decreased, but that was prior to the conflict.
Yeah.
We had to
fix that somehow.
Yeah. What I've been tracking is just like. That the issue with the tanks.
Oh, with the shipments.
That's a major hit to the United States because, I mean, the past month or two, we've been seeing like a concentration of capital towards these industrials, towards oil. I mean, that really started to take a turn after. Funny how that turns out.
Yeah.
After Donald Trump went to Greenland and got everyone mad at him, and then oil boomed because everyone's like, all right, no one's going to play games with us in tech anymore. We need to just go back to industrials.
Yeah.
All of this is compounding. And at the same time, domestically, we are having an issue with credit. And
You see how that?
So I want to talk about this.
Private segue.
Credit. Private credit, we talked about this before on the show. Private credit is essentially, as opposed to a depository institution, one that takes in deposits from regular people and other institutions and then lends them out. Private credit takes equity from investors and lends it out.
Right,
And so the benefit in that is that you can't have a run on the bank when you don't have depositors.
Mm-hmm.
You can just say, hey, we're not cashing you out. We're not cashing you out, shareholder.
Right.
And everyone knew where this was going. Everyone who studied it knew where this was going. I've talked to professors who looked at it before this ever happened and said, the big issue with private credit is that while it's great that you can prevent a run on your firm by just using equity only, the issue is when you have depository institutions and, you know, people who can have runs on their company and liquidity issues giving you money.
Right.
Because
if
a depository institution has like a semi run on their bank and they need to pull out liquidity from you, they can't do it.
Right.
Because they gave it to you in equity and now they can't redeem it. And so like that's the major risk is that when JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley gives money to a private credit institution and they need it back, they can't get it if things are going wrong. And what we're seeing here is what happens when things are going wrong. So this happened 2 weeks ago with Blue Owl Capital. They are the major lender for the AI infrastructure build out.
Ooh.
I'm sure you've heard of them.
Blue Owl Capital? I never heard of Blue. Or have I? No, I don't think I have. No, the name... I'm thinking of Owl House. See, this is where my brain... I'm learning so much, though. Okay. I'm learning so much right now.
So, Blue Owl Capital is a private credit fund. Well, they do private equity as well, but their private credit lending was a huge boom in the past year because they were throwing money at Meta. They were throwing money at Oracle to build out infrastructure on AI.
Okay.
And so they would set up these special, special purpose vehicles, SPVs, where they lend the money... and then they create this company, and then the company leases the warehouse back to Meta.
Oh, this was the circle thing.
Yeah, this was all part of the circle thing.
Yep, I have heard about this. See, if you talked about it as the circle thing, then we'd be like step to step. But,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So
no,
I'm picking up what you put.
I'm catching your cold here. I gotcha.
Yeah. So 2 weeks ago they had a liquidity event, and they had to limit redemptions. Basically, they had to limit withdrawals from their fund from shareholders.
Oh, boy.
And their stock has slid significantly. It went down from, I think it was 16 to they're at 8.75 right now.
We're going to check your work real quick.
Yeah, check it.
I believe you. I believe you should have, just before the show, Steven was just like bogged down with more news articles on his computer than I've ever seen. I gotta tell you, becoming a subject matter expert in anything in 15 minutes, fascinating stuff to me.
Okay, so when I had first started talking about Blue Owl, it was at, let's see, that would have been mid-October. They were at $17 a share. They're currently at $8.61.
Oh boy.
They've taken a huge tumble. It's down 14 past week. They're down 31 past month. They're down, what, 54 in the past 6 months.
Oh, boy.
And it keeps drawing out because they were the most risky with their lending. And, you know, as a private credit firm, that's not necessarily a bad thing. They're built for that kind of thing. They're built for risky lending.
Yeah, but gotta crack a few eggs, make it
the issue is that if firms who need that money, who have to give that money to other people, are giving money to you, then we see an issue.
Right.
And this week, the cracks are widening because Morgan Stanley, last week they announced plans to lay off 3% of their workforce.
Oh, boy.
Literally yesterday, following up in Blue Owl's pants down moment, they are also restricting redemptions of their private credit fund. And that is terrifying.
So some companies are on the hook now.
That potentially, first of all, because private credit firms lend to each other, that could also be an issue of, that could have been caused by Blue Owl in part. It also could have just been, entirely separate, like the crowd's getting spooked with Blue Owl, and so they're going to pull out. But Morgan Stanley had to cut their redemptions. And what's terrifying about this is that Morgan Stanley is a depository institution.
I have some money with Morgan Stanley.
Yeah. So when they have a private credit fund, it would stand to reason that a larger portion of their clients would be depository institutions, insurance companies, people who need to pay out when times get tough.
Who are going to be on the hook.
Yes. And then, all that aside, private credit aside, all of the RJR Nabisco, you know, demons, you know, taking all this crazy leverage credit, 11% APR, whatever. Put that all aside. At the same time, because of the fluctuations in commodity prices, we are seeing margin calls on major commodities traders.
Ooh.
Because I don't know if you took a look at oil prices.
I've taken a look at gas prices as I've driven by and cussed under my breath, yes.
Yes. So, I mean, that's delayed. The price you pay at the pump is a bit delayed from what oil futures are actually looking like.
Good. Keep delaying it.
I mean, you'll see. You'll probably see where it goes.
Oh, boy.
Oil hit $100 a barrel on Sunday today.
I did hear that.
It hit 114 WTI. It dropped after, the Trump administration promised that this is going to be over soon. The Strait of Hormuz is going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen. There are mines in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going to be fine about that.
Yeah. So then, we hit 100 again. The IEA determines that, we've got to release our stockpiles of oil. They released 400 million barrels of crude oil from their stockpiles to soften the market. And let's
see. Release it into what?
into the market. Like they,
oh, into
they,
the,
they
okay.
stockpiles.
I thought you meant like they intentionally did like a BP. See how much I'm learning here?
So they released 400 million barrels from their stockpiles to soften the effect.
Okay.
We are still at $95 a barrel.
Oh, boy.
This was essentially priced in.
Oh, and it's going up. Oh, boy.
Yeah, we're looking... It's not looking great on crude oil.
You can see where... Oh, no, that's for the day. That's for...
No, it's still moving.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's... Yeah, it's going... Yeah. But I thought... For a second, I saw that dip, and I thought, oh, well, yeah, there's the release, and but that
no,
was...
No, yeah. That was... I mean, that was... It, we... Today, we... troughed at 89
lovely.
A barrel. I mean,
lovely.
If you
yeah,
take
we're
a
back.
Look at where we were the same time last year, oil prices were still high, but they were at 68. This is far and above where we should be at.
It's almost double.
Yeah. Look, any company that has a natural long position on oil, essentially, or a natural short position on oil, basically that just means yeah. that at some point in the future, they will need to buy oil.
Right.
Like, they have a necessary need to
yeah,
buy
yeah,
oil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so... Fertilizer, like the
yeah.
production of fertilizer, and you know any like plastics, mm-hmm. everything,
manufacturing,
literally everything that has a short natural short position on oil. If they were not properly hedged for this, which who could have been properly hedged for
no.
this? This is so far beyond anything you would like think to hedge for.
No, yeah.
You're screwed. And so you know, this is what we're looking at. We're looking at $7 billion in credit has been lined up. From commodities traders to bail themselves out of margin calls.
Jeez.
To just, you know, inject liquidity so they don't get margin called, so they don't, like, have their positions collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And what's concerning is that we know what rates are at.
Right.
When all these people are having, when all these lenders are having issues, these rates are not going to be good. I mean, money's tight.
Yeah.
Money's tight. Cash is needed for the AI infrastructure build-out. Private mm-hmm. credits throwing everything at everywhere with the insane interest rates. These people are not getting good deals who are yeah. trying to restructure to avoid margin calls. And if you're delaying it, it's not going to end well unless literally angels come down from the sky and, you know, save you.
Yeah.
You know?
Wouldn't it be crazy if this causes the AI bubble to pop? Wouldn't that be wild? Wouldn't that be so wild?
I battle with that because it's hard to tell what the AI bubble popping will look like.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, certainly there is a great deal of value that's already been achieved with AI.
Well, yeah, of course.
Nowhere near what the hyperscalers are paying for.
Right,
though.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it to some extent, it's a little sketchy the way that people are like, if you don't invest in this, you'll fall behind. That's a little too far out there for me.
I agree.
That's not very convincing. Maybe it worked during the dot-com bubble, but you know, for anyone with more than a goldfish's memory, you know, it's a bit risky to kind of everyone pile in on this. You know.
Yeah. It smells like Lehman Brothers. Smells like Enron.
It smells like Enron with what Meta's doing. Honestly.
Yeah. Oh well, with the Circle thing.
No, sorry. It smells like Enron with what Oracle's doing.
Oh.
Oracle's RPOs. I don't know if you heard about this. You've got to check this out. It's in their accounting balance sheet tricks. They're writing off the value of contracts in like as basically as revenue, not really as revenue, but they're writing it on their shareholders' reports. They're not counting it as revenue, but they're
revenue
writing it
to the date of the contract.
No, but they're just saying like, yeah, we've got contracts that will be worth around this much when the time comes. And the issue is that we don't know what these contracts look like. These contracts
yeah.
could break up over nothing.
Yeah,
and
which
is
very
it,
similar to what
writing
happened
it
Enron.
In drums up a lot of investor confidence and
mm-hmm.
boosts your stock price, but.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I mean, we've seen it in their RPOs. If you look from, I believe, 2 quarters ago to 3 quarters ago, they had like $60 billion randomly.